Okay, my name is Brandon Bergman. I'm the secretary for Division 50, the Society for Addiction Psychology, and I'm the host today of the live podcast, the live podcast of Division 50, so today's date is December 1st, and I'll first introduce our guest, and then we'll get the conversation started, and we'll pause here and there for questions, so hopefully you guys will have some questions along the way. So Dr. Kate Pivovarova is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and she's a licensed clinical psychologist specializing in work with forensic populations. Her interest in working with individuals involved in the criminal justice system and dealing with mental illness dates back to college, when she was double major in psychology and criminal justice at the College of New Jersey. She received her PhD in clinical psychology with concentration in forensics at Fordham University in New York. While in graduate school, Dr. Pivovarova sought out clinical training experiences with disenfranchised populations, including working in the psychiatric emergency room of Busy City Hospital in South Bronx, working with Fordham Law School Clinic to evaluate indigent defendants, and conducting competency to stand trial, criminal responsibility, and risk assessments with psychiatrically hospitalized patients. Dr. Pivovarova completed her clinical internship at Bellevue Hospital Center and the New York University School of Medicine. Afterwards, she pursued a clinical forensic psychology fellowship at University of Massachusetts Medical School, where she conducted forensic psychological evaluations and worked as a core clinician. As a core clinician, she conducted Section 35 evaluations. Those are civil commitments for mandatory treatment for substance use disorder. Next, Dr. Pivovarova did a research fellowship at the Massachusetts General Hospital Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. During this time, she examined the applicability of novel technologies such as transcranial direct current stimulation and neuroimaging to identify lie detection to psycholegal questions. Since 2015, Dr. Pivovarova has been research faculty at the University of Massachusetts Department of Psychiatry Law and Psychiatry Program. There, her research examines two areas. First, treatment of substance use disorder using court-mandated programs for individuals involved with the criminal justice system, which she's going to tell us all about. And the second is a bioethics of research, including examining approaches to conducting multi-site research through the use of single IRBs. And so with that, and I have a couple of objectives here which will help me kind of formulate my questions for Dr. Pivovarova, and I'll probably just call her Kate if that's okay with everybody, because Pivovarova is hard for me to say.
Yes, absolutely.
hard for me to say. if that's okay with you, Kate. So with that, we'll just get sort of started. And I mean, the first question I had for you, and I'm sure our audience is interested in just kind of starting from the basics in terms of what it means to be a forensic psychologist. You know, I talked a little bit about your training, but like sort of how would you define for our listeners what it means to be specifically a forensic psychologist, what your training was like, and how that informs your work today?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great place to start. So forensic psychology is really psychology that deals with the courts. And there are a couple of pieces. One of them has to do with more clinical aspects. So things like evaluations of competency to stand trial, which is the question of how does the person present currently and if they are able to proceed with their case now, or things like evaluations of insanity or criminal responsibility, which deal with questions about what the person's mental state was like at the time that they allegedly committed the offense. And it also involves things like risk assessment. So is this person a risk to themselves or others? And if so, do they require a certain type of hospitalization, whether at a high security or lower security? So essentially the clinical aspect of forensic psychology, which is the route that I took, was to look at the interaction between mental illness and some form of capacities or abilities that the patient may have that are related to a legal question. There are also other aspects of forensic psychology, and sometimes it's called legal psychology, and that has to do with questions of, say, eyewitness testimony or other more sort of investigational types of questions that don't necessarily involve issues of mental health necessarily, but certainly use psychological concepts to examine psycholegal ideas.
Really interesting. So, I mean, if you can answer this as just a follow-up question, I mean, it sounds like there's just a really major overlap, right, between legal issues and psychological issues in the legal system and the criminal justice system and the training that we get as clinical psychologists. So what do you feel like, if you can answer this, what do you feel like were the most important aspects of your training as a psychologist or as a psychology student when you were in grad school and then when you graduated, like on internship and fellowship?
Mm-hmm.
What did you feel like were the most important aspects of that training to be able to prepare you to actually carry out some of these responsibilities in the court system and things like that? So kind of what do you feel like were the biggest pieces of your training that helped you along the way?
Sure. I'd say probably the base of everything is that I am a clinical psychologist, and my training is in clinical psychology. It is about what does mental illness look like, what are some of the effects of mental illness symptoms, what are the different treatments, and things that we would normally see in clinical psychology. The focus then is on applying those to psycho-legal concepts. So whether it be individuals who are involved in the criminal justice system or in evaluating a particular question. So what's really helpful and I think is critical is to really understand, and maybe I say this because my other area of interest is ethics, but really sort of the boundaries between those two fields and sort of the ethical responsibilities that one has as a clinical psychologist working within the criminal justice system, since that is their system, and what we're doing is just coming in and giving an opinion about a particular issue, not necessarily changing the system, certainly not changing the system from the inside or asking them to follow whatever guidelines we may have. So the core of it is being a clinical psychologist to the best of one's ability, learning as much as you can, and sort of certainly doing as many internships and externships with a variety of different populations, especially those with substance use disorders, and then being very clear about what some of those boundaries are between the two fields and what are some of the ethical principles that might be unique when doing the evaluation. So for me, certainly, having the experience of being on internship at Bellevue, and while there I was on the forensic unit there, which holds individuals who are coming in from Rikers Island who are too ill to be handled at Rikers Island, it was really important to try to understand sort of what do I do, what does their criminal case have to do with anything that I'm doing, and, uh-huh. and sort of operating between those two fields.
Yeah, and so it's like, and I'm going to open it up for questions in a second, but just to reflect that back, it's like really, really taking your training as a psychologist in terms of understanding psychopathology and the ways that we assess and address psychopathology and learning how, I think it sounds like, learning how to implement those within a system that exists. And that, like you were saying, you can't change, but certainly you can think about how to operate within those systems. And so your training really helps set you up to be able to do that well. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And so it involves a lot of very specialized training, just like you would have, say, specialized training within another field like neuropsychology or something along those lines, where during graduate school I took a few law courses that I was able to, really fortunate while at Fordham, we had a program where I was able to take courses and work with the Fordham Law School. And then certainly on fellowship at UMass, you have didactics once a week for sort of the entirety of the year for a full day that go through all of the critical cases that you need to know in order to be able to work with the courts. Because you are in some ways, as a forensic psychologist, as a clinical forensic psychologist, you're certainly there to teach the court and the individuals that you're working with about psychological concepts, but you need to know what's going on broadly, sort of why this principle this way or that way. So yeah, certainly sort of being able to get the two fields and trying to work between them is fascinating, absolutely fascinating work, and I think very important work.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so, and I do, and I there's obviously lots of follow-up questions I have, but I just wanted to pause for a second and see if anybody out there had any questions as Kate kind of introduced what it means, at least for her, to be a Frankfurt psychologist in the training that she went about. Again, does anybody have any questions about that piece of things for her? Not all at once. Okay.
Well, fantastic. I'm going to assume that's because I explained it so clearly. I will take silence as only that.
David Eddy here. I have a quick question. And I have a feeling actually this might even be Brandon's next question, but I'm curious to know how your training was informed by substance use disorder or the amount of substance use disorder training forensic psychologists get while they're in grad school or on internship.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And, you know, I think that unfortunately it's not enough. It's not enough because in some ways what you're often faced with when you're asked a particular forensic question, so for instance, issues of competency, when you're deciding, does this particular person have the mental capacity at this moment to work with their attorney and to be able to proceed with the case as is, you're often trying to separate out factors, and you want to in some ways separate out substance use and you want to separate out mental illness, and because of some of the intricacies in how the law works, substance use is not generally considered a mental illness that would make someone incompetent or a sort of not responsible for the offenses. So a lot of the times, at least as an evaluator piece, and that's certainly not all that forensic psychologists do, but as an evaluator, you're sort of trying to pull that piece out and say, okay, well, here's substance use, and then here's everything else. Now, in practice, of course, that makes very little sense because we know how involved substance use is and certainly how much it informed and sort of controlled many people's lives. But, you know, sort of I think at least as you're going through graduate school and trying to learn some of those concepts that I mentioned where you're trying to learn the law and the mental illness piece, and the substance use, there, at least for me, or at least the course that I chose to partake, didn't necessarily focus very much on substance use. Having said that, it was almost impossible to not talk about substance use when working in the criminal justice population because, and as I'll go on sort of to talk about why it's so critical to look at criminal justice populations, the majority of individuals who are involved with the criminal justice system have substance use or have had it at some point in their lifetime and certainly impact many, many aspects, if not all aspects of their lives. So I've observed this, certainly, but didn't focus as much during my training on that and certainly wish that I had and now have been very fortunate to try to learn a lot more about it and sort of the integration of substance use into the criminal justice system and sort of some of these other important features to try to wholly understand what individuals involved in the criminal justice system are experiencing.
Thanks. Yeah. So does any, I mean, I obviously have lots of follow-up questions there because that really does take us into the first big objective of I know what Kate wanted to talk about, what I really wanted to hear about, but does anybody else out there have any follow-up questions or other questions for Kate at this point? No, okay,
Actually, go ahead. It doesn't, this is Bruce Leach, president of Division 50, Society of Addiction Psychology. Kate, not necessarily now, but two things. Having testified only a couple of times, I committed to never doing it again unless I was subpoenaed. So two things I'd love to have you talk about. Number one is the other side, squeezing you hard to prove that you're not competent to do your job and how you handle that. And the other one is when to say no to an opportunity to consult on a case because you, for whatever reason, don't believe it would be the right thing to do. So those are two questions I will definitely want answered based on what was just a couple of experiences that led me to say, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are great questions, and in some ways I think it goes along so well with what I mentioned before, which was some of the critical training that I needed to get was not just in psychology, but also in the law, in order to try to understand some of these things, sort of what testimony was like, and what are very clear boundaries about what you know and you don't. And I agree with you. Testifying is a frightening experience. But I guess the way that I started to think about it, and this has to do with a ton of training, and I'm so grateful for sort of all of the opportunities that I had dating back to graduate school to do mock trial with different law schools and to then get feedback and essentially the same type of training that one would get if they were doing therapy and there's observation is what some of the graduate programs and certainly the fellowship at UMass does, just that you're recorded and then you speak with your supervisor about what do you look like on the stand, sort of are you looking at people weirdly or are you really nervous and tapping your foot. So some of that is, at least for me, was getting a ton of feedback. The other piece that really helps me to think about it when I testify is that, you know, I am there to educate the court about the piece that I know. So I know a little bit about mental illness, and I've had time to evaluate this person, and I feel comfortable enough to offer an opinion about this. So absolutely the other lawyer's job is to make me look like I don't know what I'm talking about. And that's fine. There's nothing really that I'm going to do. I think there are some sort of guidelines about how one handles and certainly some really great books about how one testifies. But I think the idea being that I'm just one piece of the answer or one piece of sort of the picture that the court is going to have about this particular individual, and as long as I do my best, you know, the other lawyer's doing his or her best, and whatever is going to come out of it is going to come out of it. I find myself sort of spending quite a bit of time before testimony and just making sure that I'm sort of in the right mind frame, that it's not to get agitated and to say, no, I know what I'm doing, because I know what I'm doing with respect to one particular piece and certainly not with everything else. And so that leads into your other questions, which is knowing where your boundaries are. And that has to do with competence. And so we certainly talk about competence in clinical psychology broadly, but with forensics, it's so clear because the moment you step outside of those boundaries, you're going to be told in court that this, have you done this before? How many times before have you done this? So you certainly are very wary of doing something that you might not know. And I certainly have turned down many evaluations, which sometimes is difficult because coming out of graduate school, everyone is sort of looking to try to support themselves financially as much as possible and to try as many new things as you can. But you know, I can imagine that one bad experience of doing something that you don't quite know what you're doing just because you want to stretch yourself would be enough for most people to never do that again. So certainly in this field, I very rarely, if ever, take on things that I haven't spent a lot of time getting training in and a lot of time doing this type of work.
Yeah, and I can imagine these kinds of the issues around your own kind of your strength, your own strengths, and maybe what you're still working on, or just really recognizing your strengths and what you're best at is especially relevant. And I think about this in my own work, even though I'm not a forensic psychologist, as an early career psychologist, right? Because there's no way around this fact that, like, we just are not going to have as much experience as somebody who's been doing what we've been doing for 25, 30 years. Now, I think there are advantages to being early in our careers, certainly like in a context of getting on a stand, for example. But I have to imagine that they're sort of picking on you for being early career and having a certain amount of experience or not. Is that a false assumption that I'm making on that end?
I think they do, but I find... I mean, maybe, again, I'm so used to being like, this is not about me, right? They're just doing their job.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I were in their shoes, I would do the exact same thing. And I would say, oh, how many publications do you have? Well, this other doctor had three times as many. Or you've only been practicing for X number of years. Well, that means you don't know what you're doing. And honestly, I haven't really had that many... very negative experiences. I think where it's complicated, I actually find most frustrating when they don't let you get the thought out. Because sometimes the concepts that we're talking about are complicated. Well, sometimes. All the time. They're all complicated. And so the worst of it is when they cut you off and you know what the rules are and sort of you can't keep talking. So, you know, I think the first part for me has been easier to just say, sure, it's not really about me. That's what they're doing. But when I feel like I haven't done a good enough job in describing a particular idea, that's what I find most frustrating. And oftentimes what happens is whichever side, whether you're working for the DA or if you're working with the defense or if you're working for the court, the other side, whoever sort of you're working with will recognize that, or at least many of the very good lawyers will recognize that there's some things that you want to get across and they'll give you an opportunity later on.
Right.
Kate, well,
that makes sense. Go ahead, Bruce.
Everything you said is so interesting and helpful. Thank you for answering my questions. This is just a follow-up. In the area that we all work in, addictive behaviors, addictions, we get calls a lot from people who have been told by an attorney, you need to show that you have a psychologist. You need a psychologist. You need to be in therapy. You need to be in treatment. What do you recommend to people to be aware of the possibility that they're going to be pulled into some kind of, into forensic activities or into testifying or whatever, because that's how I ended up in it. I was, I thought I was just seeing somebody to evaluate them, and there was a lot more going on in the background.
Yeah, so since I don't do sort of treatment, I don't have, I'm not as clear on what all those guidelines are, but certainly this is where I think the code of ethics for psychologists is critical. And certainly all of the people that are working with individuals who have substance use disorder, there's a very high probability that they're going to have some sort of criminal justice involvement. And there are rules to protect sort of treatment providers from having to submit notes and things like that. But certainly requires, at least from sort of where I stand, it requires incredible clarity about what you're doing, which is, you know, why are you asking certain questions? I find that sometimes with individuals who have criminal justice involvement, you certainly get a fascinating story that's there. And oftentimes the story itself is not really important. What's important is sort of the circumstances around it and sort of the experiences and sort of all of that. So I can imagine, especially when working people who are involved with the criminal justice system, if your job is to do treatment or it is to do the evaluation, getting into the specifics of, you know, the offenses, especially sort of things that might be not necessarily directly to the evaluation, can be problematic if you're going to get sort of asked to testify about this in court. But I think that's probably the extent of what I can offer in terms of sort of what I could see. The guidance around it, the sort of the broader issue are, of course, safety issues, right? And that's sort of the standard evaluation that one would have to do and be able to document it very clearly. So for me, documentation has always been really, really important, so I can sort of provide evidence of myself having done a very good job. But in those questions, I think I would certainly always go back to the ethics guidelines about conducting sort of proper evaluations or proper treatments. So whatever happens in court, you can go back and say, whatever they're trying to say that, you know, or whatever information they're trying to get from you, you would know what the practical standards are, which are different for non-forensic evaluations than from forensic psychologists.
And I love
Thank you.
And I loved what you said there, Kate, about kind of the how important the clarity around the questions that they're after and kind of what they're specifically, what is it that they're looking for, and then having a complete clarity on the other side where we're telling them, like, hey, look, this is what we can do, and these are the questions that we hear that you're asking, and this is what we can actually provide answers to. This is actually what the answers will or won't sound like, and that, you know, and just in my I don't have any experience for the audience. Just I'll sort of answer that question a little bit from the side, and then I really want to ask you, Kate, about the intersection between the criminal justice system and substance disorder. But when in thinking about just substance use disorder more broadly, I'm oftentimes people are coming and asking questions like, can I drink in moderation, or can I do this without treatment, right? And so for me, it's important to clarify what they're asking when they ask those questions, and then at the same time being very clear on the other end of, like, okay, well, here's the ways I can provide those answers to you, and here are the actual services based on my experience and expertise that I can provide you. And that just that clarity and that transparency from the jump, I have found to be really helpful, especially early career psychologist.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, actually. Sort of, I think I should mention that, and I think it's sort of related to the difference in the fields too, is that every time that I see an individual, I give a disclosure statement, which sort of goes like, I am here to evaluate you because of XYZ. I am not your doctor. I have been asked to evaluate you by XYZ. I might have to testify about the things that you say, and then I explain sort of how confidentiality works, which is a little bit different in certain cases where you're working for the defense versus the court or the DA. And so I do that confidentiality warning, and everyone who sort of works in forensic settings, including clinicians, do that every single time they see the person. I won't say every single time, but, you know, broadly, every time most people do, including at a forensic hospital. So then the treatment team, sort of there's a description of everything that you say might end up in court. And so I think there's at least that, like, frame that's set around what the interaction is like. And so I could imagine that it would also be really helpful to explain that there are, as you would normally, as you would do disclosure, but sort of if you feel like this is a riskier case and riskier being more likely to end up in court or there's some issues involved, sort of setting that frame often. Even if you're repeating yourself, you know, it's sort of you have your clinical intuition that helps you make decisions. And certainly there might be cases where it's helpful to set the frame about what you're doing, what your role is, and sort of if they're involved, if they're on probation, sort of what are some of the possibilities. So some psychologists certainly provide therapy for probationers and are often asked to report back, not about sort of everything that went on in the session, but whether the patient came in or not. So certainly, I guess the frame thing, as you point out, Brandon, is something that would be very helpful.
Right. Yeah, the frame. Yeah. So I think thank you for talking about kind of some of the background about what it means to be a forensic psychologist. I think it was obviously really helpful for me as someone who does work in the addiction treatment field, but doesn't necessarily have that kind of criminal justice expertise to get that perspective. And, you know, we talked about it before. I just think that we have this, and, you know, I'm sort of going to, it'll be a repetition for you, but maybe not for the audience. There's, like you were talking about before, there's like this tremendous overlap between the addiction treatment or the substance disorder treatment world and the criminal justice or the forensic psychology world. But oftentimes we find ourselves separated academically, separated kind of, and then like in practice, clinically, despite the fact that there's just this really strong overlap, where I think it behooves folks on both sides to have expertise in both areas. And so I think this would be a nice time just to talk broadly about, like, you know, why you feel like it's important to address substance use disorder in criminal justice populations, and vice versa, why it's important to think about legal or criminal justice issues in substance use disorder populations. And then kind of one broad thing I'm hoping to talk a little bit about for folks that are listening is, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know if controversy is the right word. I think discussion maybe is a better way to put it, but certainly very heated discussion about the role of the criminal justice system and how we address substance use disorder, at least kind of in our modern ethos. I think for a long time, right, it was just all criminal justice. And now we think about the public health implications, or we're thinking about it from a public health perspective. But like you and I have talked about, like there are data, for example, to suggest that patients that are mandated treatment through the criminal justice system have as good or sometimes better outcomes, right, than those who are non-mandated. And so there are lots of different reasons why. But I was just hoping, kind of in the context of thinking about these issues, you could talk a little bit about the role of the criminal justice system to help folks with substance disorder, and also maybe potentially from your experience or any data that you're familiar with, the potential harms around the criminal justice system and substance disorder, perhaps like with these really, sometimes I know there's a lot of publicity or sort of press around these really long sentences for relatively low impact substance use related crimes, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I was hoping you could talk about those broader issues too at the same time, if you could.
Sure. So let me start towards the broader picture, which you alluded to, which is that there is an incredible overlap between substance use disorders and the criminal justice system. And some of the numbers are truly shocking. And as someone who has worked with forensic populations, you certainly see it. But I don't think I've truly appreciated until I started to look at the research just how common it is. So some of the research suggests that up to 75% of individuals that have been incarcerated have some sort of substance use disorder, lifetime prevalent substance use disorder. I think that's probably the higher end, but certainly 50s and 60s is very common, a little bit more common in women than in men. But the sort of takeaway point is, huge numbers of individuals involved in the criminal justice system have substance use disorder, have met criteria for that. The second piece of that is that the most common reason for incarceration in both state and federal prison, and there's sort of a difference, not sure it's worth discussing now, but is for drug offenses.
Yeah.
Meaning that the majority of the people going into prison are specifically for drug-related crimes, and the data sort of fluctuates, but sort of some of this comes from Brookings Institutes and other DOJ types of sources. So you have those two pieces. So they're going in for drugs. They have the met criteria. Most of them have met criteria. And now what we're seeing is that nationwide, and this is research that came out about 10 years ago or so that sort of really shook the, I think, criminal justice world, there was a finding that said that offenders who have just recently been released from jails or prisons, some sort of a correctional facility, were 12 times more likely to die of an overdose in the first 2 months of release as compared to individuals in the community. And just to take that up a notch, Massachusetts recently came out with a finding that said individuals in Massachusetts, and for those of you not in Massachusetts, Massachusetts and so the New England area has been hit incredibly hard with the opioid epidemic, certainly everywhere in the state, but there are hot spots around the country, and Massachusetts is one of those states. Our individuals in Massachusetts are 55 times more likely to match community members to die of a drug overdose.
Holy crap.
In the first 2 months, yeah. Those numbers are just absolutely shocking. And, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg about the data. I can go on and on, but I think that's certainly enough. I mean, there's, you know, studies that, including coming out of Scotland and Ireland, a little bit data now, but saying that for offenders, the number one cause of death who have recently been released, the number one cause of death over heart attack is overdose from drugs. So I think the way I see it, and I think most people instead of looking at the data, is that you essentially cannot, and you know, this is a bold statement, feel comfortable making, you cannot treat the opioid epidemic without directly addressing the criminal justice system, because these are individuals that are hit by the opioid epidemic and have severe substance use disorders that need immediate help. They're both going into prison for a lot of these drug-related offenses, and they're coming out and are an incredibly high risk of overdose, not to mention continued substance use and many, many other diseases, including spread of and getting infectious diseases. So sort of the way I see it, and I hope other people can see it as well, is that you essentially need to address the criminal justice system population if we're going to address the opioid epidemic, because that is where we're going to get those high-risk offenders. So the way that it has been done in the criminal justice system, there are a number of ways. I'd say sort of one of the more common ones and longstanding ones has been the development of specialty courts that address criminal justice, that address drug use, and they're called drug treatment courts. They're becoming more and more popular. They started back in 1989, and they were developed in Miami in order to try to reduce, and this is an important piece, to reduce criminal justice involvement. So the thinking was, if you can get people to stop using drugs, then we're not going to have all of those associated crimes that some might be committing in order to get drugs or as a result of using drugs. They were developed for criminal justice purposes, which is to reduce reoffending, and certainly reduction in substance use was a piece of it, but that was not the intent.
So the reduction of substance use was more the means to an end
in
terms of their original creation, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think there are maybe some theoretical, conceptual ways of thinking. I'm not sure that that has sort of stuck through, and certainly I think not the way that most people think about it, but that is important in thinking how this idea of these specialty courts came into the way we think about it. And so since then, there has been a large increase in these courts, and there's now over like 3,200 or so courts around the country. There is an organization that if you look up drug treatment court, you'll be able to get to. I want to make sure I don't get the wrong name. I'll give this to you guys. I'll look to give you the website, and you can look to see just where those drug courts are all around the country in every single state and territory in the United States. And so what these drug courts do is they provide an alternative sentence to an individual. Sometimes they're used as a means of probation, essentially doing this. An individual is told, you have been charged with crime XYZ. You can either go into prison and serve 1 year. You're going to get out. You're going to still have a drug abuse problem, and you're probably going to get reincarcerated. Or you can come into our drug treatment program, and then you're not going to be incarcerated. You might be incarcerated for a very small amount of time, but then you're going to enter our drug treatment court, which is a very closely monitored program where you're going to have to show up in court every week or every 2 weeks. You're going to have probation officers. You're going to have to enter some sort of treatment, usually treatment like rehabilitation facility where you're there for a couple of months. You're going to have all of these restrictions, and if you don't follow them, then we're essentially going to reincarcerate you for the, oftentimes it'll be for the original amount of time that you would have gotten had you not done this. And so you're using, what you're doing is you're leveraging the possibility of a really harsh sentence, or even oftentimes not even a very harsh sentence, but a sentence period, by saying you're mandated to go into treatment.
So just to interrupt for 1 second, I just, in terms of the treatment itself, does the person who's in the drug court, do they get to choose sort of what the treatment looks like, or from a range of options, or is the court not only mandating them the treatment, or not really mandating, but giving them a choice of sort of treatment mm-hmm. through this drug court system or jail, or do they get the choice of what they're going to do for treatment, or does the mm-hmm. court say, like, this is what your treatment's going to look like?
So that's a fantastic question. I'd say the easiest way to answer is yes, the court gets to choose what treatment they get, but their court is not necessarily acting as a clinician. So there's usually clinicians that are involved in drug court. And what drug court looks like, for those of you who have not been, and I suspect most of you haven't, I strongly recommend you go. It looks incredibly different than a regular court. It's a very supportive environment. The drug court, it operates as a team, with a judge being essentially like the leader of the team. But as part of the team, both the DA, usually the prosecutor, and the defense attorney work together. There's usually a case manager or social worker that's involved. Oftentimes probation officers are involved. Oftentimes there are other individuals that are involved in the community, all working to try to get the appropriate treatment, the appropriate management of the individual who's enrolled in court to make sure that they're able to stay sober. And so what, in the past, I think this is an important change to know, in the past, some of the drug treatment courts were fairly opposed to medication-assisted treatment. And as a result, they would say, if you want to be in drug court, you can't be on medication-assisted treatment. And
yeah.
In the last couple of years, that has changed drastically. The guidelines for drug treatment courts have said you are no longer allowed to do that. You need to allow people, if they want to be on medication-assisted treatment. So the court will say, here are the, you know, they might say you have to be in a residential facility. You have to go see this doctor and talk to them about medication-assisted treatment. They can't go as far as to say you need to be on methadone or Vivitrol.
So the recommendation they would make would be to talk to a physician or a prescriber about medication rather than you need to be on a particular kind of medication.
Exactly. And I think recommendation is sort of saying it softly. It's mandatory. Right? I mean, it's mandatory to go and talk to a case manager. If, you know, they might not mandate them to go talk to specifically to a physician about receiving some sort of medication-assisted treatment. They're certainly mandated to do everything else. They can say no, and if they say no, the answer tends to be, okay, well, you can't be in drug treatment court, and now you have to go back to whatever sort of original charges were, or if you were on probation, you go back to regular probation and sort of some version of that. It's very much leveraging the power of the court to try to get individuals into treatment.
And so I'm just kind of keeping track of time, and with 15 minutes left, I want to make sure to ask you about your work, kind of the research on drug courts broadly, and your work that you're doing on individuals that go through drug courts. But before I ask you that question, I want to just kind of see if anybody that's listening has any questions of their own for Kate about what drug courts are, what their purpose is, what they do. Anything at all?
Oh, I can't resist. I'll make it really quick. I really want to hear about Kate's work. So let me make this
who's
one really
this,
quick.
Who's this?
This.
I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
This is Bruce. Kate, based on the research you have looked at, can you give us a kind of forensic perspective on what you think the research says about the advantages and disadvantages of marijuana legalization, recreational marijuana legalization?
Oh, my God. That's a good question.
Like one or two. Yeah, because that's got to be.
I feel very comfortable saying there are many things I don't know, and this is certainly one of them. What I will say sort of related to this, so first I think there are two bigger issues. One is, for the most part, marijuana is still illegal. So depending on sort of what court people are involved in federal court, it doesn't really matter. So they have some sort of involvement with federal court. They cannot use marijuana, even if the state allows it. For all of the courts that I've certainly observed and most courts that I'm familiar with, despite it being legal in the state, it is still not allowed to, most people who are in drug treatment courts are not allowed to use marijuana. That's sort of the extent of my knowledge. And what I do want to point out is, in some ways, and I think this sort of is important to think about when we're talking about restrictions that many of these individuals have, is it's not just restrictions on marijuana. I mean, they're not allowed to be using alcohol either.
I was going to ask you that, Kate, about because alcohol is legal, but I would imagine they're still expected to be absent from alcohol as well.
Absolutely. So I think, I certainly can't answer your question, Bruce, about sort of the specifics. I have not looked at that literature, but the broader is that the courts will restrict the individual's access to things that are even legal in the community were they not involved with the courts at the time. And I think that's that's a very difficult thing for many people to sort of come to terms with, especially because at least the number of individuals that I have interviewed have said, well, I know what my problem is. My problem is heroin. I use that. I don't care about alcohol. So if I'm out, I'll drink a little bit. But that's sort of how I engage socially. And now, this is not to say sort of that that's okay, because that doesn't mean that that's sort of okay for them. And it might be, right? We don't know. But certainly, while they're being monitored, if they come up as having had a drink in the past day, right, because alcohol sort of stays in your system a little bit shorter, then they're considered to have violated one of the terms of their drug treatment court guidelines. So it's difficult. So that's my answer to marijuana. I believe what I've done, as you probably have recognized, is I've shifted to talking about what I know.
I think all of us could just sit and listen to you all day. So what you talked about was great. I want to be quiet because I love that Brandon's asking you about your own work.
So I was in the kind of time that we have remaining just to spend, and if anybody has questions, please kind of feel free. But I'm really interested in hearing more about, Kate, about just kind of your work on drug courts, how you think about them. I mean, clearly you see, I know we did just kind of to double back for anybody listening, I don't know, we didn't get to talk about kind of the harms of the drug court, but I'm just much more, for time purposes, I'm just much more interested in hearing about your research. And I could tell from the way that you talk that you see a role for the drug courts, right, in kind of broader problem resolution and recovery from substance use disorder. And so maybe just tell everybody about the way that you think about drug courts and addressing substance disorder and then your work in that world.
I think this sort of will address that piece too. I think there are no perfect programs, and there are issues with drug courts like there are with every single program. And most people who are involved in drug courts, I think, have the very best in mind for the people who are involved with drug courts. So there are problems like there are with everything. But what we do know from the research is that drug courts are effective. There have been meta-analyses done that show that individuals who are enrolled in drug courts, including, you know, actually your research, Brandon, that has showed that sort of individuals who are mandated to engage in treatment, substance use disorder treatment by the courts, will be abstinent longer, will have fewer relapses, will have the data on overdoses isn't great, so I don't want to misstate. I don't think we have great data support that there are sort of fewer overdoses, but we do know that there is a delay in relapse, in the first time to relapse after enrolling. There's certainly very, very large amount of monitoring happening with individuals who are in drug treatment courts, so access to drugs is certainly very much restricted for many of these guys and women. And from the criminal justice sense, we do know that it means that there is less involvement in the criminal justice system for people who are involved. In other words, there are fewer numbers of arrests. They are less likely to be arrested sort of a couple of years down the line. Some numbers are sort of incredibly good for those who complete drug treatment courts. Like 75% of them don't go on to get rearrested. I think that's probably the very high end. Certainly people who do again, but many don't. The problem, the true sort of issue as I see it, is that we have an unbelievably high number of individuals who fail to complete drug treatment courts. So it's up to 75%. Some studies have found up to 75% don't complete drug treatment court. On average, that number tends to be 49%. Sort of some literature reports are a little bit different. Either way, it is very, very high. It is much higher than it should be. Because if you think about it, what's going on is you literally have probation officers, judges, and everyone else involved in trying to get you to stay clean, right? And you know that if you're going to use, there's almost 100% possibility that you're going to go back to jail. And yet people still do. We know why, right? None of this is sort of a mystery to us. But it just shows sort of the stronghold of the addiction. So the problem is that when they are kicked out of drug treatment court, and they're not kicked out for using once or twice, the drug courts are sort of, I'd say, become very cognizant of the fact that relapse is common, if not the case for most people, and certainly needs to be accommodated in drug treatment courts. But when they do fail out, and usually they're either drop out themselves, they decide they no longer want to be in it, or the court says we can no longer accommodate you, we can no longer have you in our program, they essentially go back to prison and start this entire cycle again. And not only that, from sort of a criminal justice stance, they've now just spent, say, 6 months on probation, in addition to what they would have gotten had they not started drug treatment courts. There's sort of a great cost to society at large. There's certainly a very big cost to the individual. And there's sort of another piece of, from a psychological stance, right? Someone has failed at something really big again when there have been so many people involved in trying to help them. So my goal for research has really been trying to look at what are some of the things that we can do to improve retention in drug courts. And the way that I've been looking at it, and I'll sort of wrap up after I mention this, is looking at quality of life and chronic medical conditions that individuals have. And the idea behind my research has been, well, if we can identify individuals who have sort of a lower quality of life and might have comorbid medical conditions, including whether it be Hep C or sort of anything else from coronary disease, whatever it might be, and if we can try to get them treatment at the same time that we're providing substance abuse treatment, because we certainly try to do that with mental health issues, then maybe we can try to keep those individuals who are most likely to drop out by getting to them early. And so there's some hypotheses, and I'd be happy to let other people know sort of what I've been thinking about this. I don't want to get into specifics too much, but so the lens that I'm looking at it through is quality of life, comorbid medical conditions for individuals involved in drug treatment courts, and can we develop a system that gives them treatment early on that tries to address low quality of life very quickly as they enroll in drug court and then try to keep them in drug court longer.
Yeah, I really think what you're doing is so important. Like we talked about our listeners, but in the addiction treatment world specifically, obviously got lots of treatments that are helpful in terms of, helpful is a broad term, but in terms of reducing alcohol use or other drug use or what have you. And moving towards this, we really haven't done a fantastic job of looking at other outcomes beyond substance use, sort of mm-hmm. broadly speaking, these quality of life outcomes, which can include psychological, et cetera. The way that you're thinking about it, which is really fantastic, is trying to get a sense of like, what are these factors that predict dropout from the courts, and maybe there's something going on, maybe there are factors that are not doing a very good job addressing, and that's really what's leading to retention. Maybe there are things that are really a hard time in terms of their overall day-to-day functioning, whether that's medical, psychological, they're kind of what we would call recovery capital, like their house, mm-hmm. they have, you know, their housing or what have you, their social networks. And so, I mean,
Well, let me just thank you. First of all, those compliments are fantastic. But I think that.
And I'll give you. I know we had to. So in the last minute, why don't you just take the sort of last word, and then we'll let folks go.
Sure. So I think what I've found in the literature, and I want to encourage people to look at this, is this issue of quality of life, and maybe that's sort of a good take-home message as well. Is that when you look at quality of life measurements in research with substance use disorders, it is not as high as one would expect, because quality of life is measured in almost every other condition. And there have been some papers, including a paper from like a group from NIDA that came out and said, this should be an outcome that we all look at. And yet most people don't necessarily look at that. And I think that sort of where the field at least needs to go is to incorporate the issue of quality of life, because it is so critical. And it's not to say that people aren't doing it. Certainly aren't doing it to the same degree that's being done in other medical fields and other study of other conditions.
Oh, well, yeah, thank you. We'll leave it there since it's 1 o'clock, and I just want to thank Dr. Gabe Rova, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at University of Massachusetts Medical School, for her time and sharing her thoughts on forensic psychology, such a disorder. And
Brandon, your phone is breaking up. If somebody else can repeat that, or if you can say it so that people know where to reach Kate, your phone was breaking up when you said that.
So you want Kate to leave an email address?
That would be great.
Kate, are you still on the line? Kate, can you go ahead and tell people your email address?
I will, but I don't think anyone would be able to. It's ekaterina.pivovarva@umassmed.edu. So I'm going to say no one got that. So maybe one way to do so is to send it to you guys, and if you want to send it along next time you have one of these. Another way is to sort of go through Department of Psychiatry at UMass Medical School, and my last name is Pivovarva. I think that was in the ad, and so you'll be able to find me that way.
There you go. And if folks have any questions, you could also, mine's maybe a little bit easier, bgbergman@mgh.harvard.edu. That might be a way also to get to Kate with any questions you might have as well. So with that, since it's after 1 and I want to be mindful of people's time, thank you, Kate, again for your time and your insight and sharing your expertise, and see y'all next time.
Yes, thank you so
much.
And everyone.
Okay. All right, bye.